Time now for this.
Women's Health Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic Rathas Tralee. Specialists in fertility and menopause.
Mary McCaffrey, a warm welcome to you and a happy new year.
And happy new year to you too.
You're well, I hope.
I am very well.
You got over Christmas okay?
Oh, we had a nice, quiet, relaxed Christmas with very little sort of razzmatazz, which was grand.
Yeah, nothing like it. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, listen, it's our first Women's Health slot of 2023. And we have some questions for you. But by way of a kind of a theme today, you're going to talk a little bit about some of the checks women should do when they hit 40. Why 40, first of all?
Okay, well, 40 was, I had to pick a number. And okay. I suppose when people get to 40, they're always thinking about the future, whatever. And it's the new year and people are always in the new year trying to think about New Year's resolutions and they want to lose weight and whatever. So I thought it was a good idea to for people to think about, well, what could I do to make myself healthy for the future? And we've talked in the last couple of months about menopause and whatever, and we know that women are living longer. I think 40 is a time when there's a lot of things that you can look at and say, I can make changes in my life. And a health check at 40 can be quite useful. So, for example, we know that if people have had complications in a pregnancy, they might have had high blood pressure, they might have had diabetes. There's a lot more research out now coming out that shows that that is likely to be a marker for future ill health. And there's an opportunity for change. And I think 40 is kind of a time people do think about change. So we know, for example, if someone had high blood pressure in pregnancy, preeclampsia in pregnancy, they have a much higher risk of going on to develop high blood pressure. If they've had diabetes in pregnancy, they have a huge risk of type 2 diabetes in the future for their future health. Now, we're probably not great in how we look after pregnant women in follow-up after the babies are born. They go home, they're busy with their babies. We probably don't see them except for smear checks. So it was a time for people to look and say, I'm 40, maybe I need to be looking to the future and seeing what can I do to be healthy for my next 40 years or 50 years.
Okay, and what kind of checks would you like to see them getting? I mean, the obvious ones would be cholesterol and blood pressure.
Yeah, but I think there's a place for a kind of a health check where you go and someone looks at your history, takes your history, checks your blood pressure, looks at your weight and does bloods for you and then turns around and it could be your GP that would be doing it or it could be a health check clinic that would be doing it and then gives you advice for the future lifestyle changes because a lot of it will come back to lifestyle changes and can you predict this person is likely to have diabetes or whatever. And it would involve doing cholesterol checks and would involve a lot of lifestyle changes. And lifestyle medicine is a thing. Now it's actually a specialty. And we've a few people in Kerry who've on the GP scheme have gone out and trained as junior doctors in lifestyle medicine and we're not utilising them enough. So yeah, that's just a thing. I think that as women, we don't look after ourselves.
Yeah, okay. And we, like, as we say in the little promo we use for this section, for this this slot, women often put themselves last.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we know, that I have a slide when I give talks where I show a woman in skinny jeans with her 8-year-old daughter in skinny jeans and I talk about, look at your jeans. If you go back and talk to your mother about her health and the rest of your extended family, you'll very likely find out they might have had strokes, they might have had high blood pressure. That's, again, a risk factor for you. So knowing the history of your family is important too. So, yeah, I think it's just a time for reflection.
Mm. Another thing as well is that women probably may not consider when they're in their 40s is contraception because a lot of women kind of wrongfully assume that they mightn't get pregnant in their 40s.
And they mightn't, but we get the odd surprises and we get a lot of surprises because sometimes you get a kind of a few reflex ovulation cycles as women get older and it may not be what they think about. And I suppose the other thing is outside of pregnancy, unless you're going for an appointment for pregnancy or an appointment to go on the pill, a lot of healthy women never get their blood pressure checked. Nobody ever checks them out. Most women never have their blood pressure checked before they're pregnant. Mm. So they don't know what their underlying health status is. I think it's nice to know your underlying health status. And we can reverse that because there's so many things we can help people with. So it's about looking at your status to seek help, to see how you can stay healthy.
Yeah, and it's all very well saying women are living longer, but we want women to live better.
Better, yeah. You don't want to be going around with a Zimmer frame or whatever, if you can help it. We do want to be healthy.
Yeah. Okay. We have a question for you, and we might start with this one. It's from a lady who is 53 years old. She says, I'm still having regular heavy monthly periods. No obvious signs of menopause. Is this usual? Or sorry, is this unusual?
It isn't common. I'll rephrase it like that. But for example, women who have a lot of, we know that, for example, women with polycystic ovarian syndrome in previous lives get menopauses later because their ovaries, there's just a lot more estrogen being produced by their ovaries. So it's not completely unusual. As long as the periods have a pattern to them and there's nothing suspicious and erratic about it, I'd say it's fine.
Yeah, and they probably will ease off eventually.
They will ease off eventually. I mean, I'm seeing women 55, 56 are still getting periods.
Okay. We have a 64-year-old woman. She says, after 15 years of sleepless nights, she has gone on HRT. She says, it's changed my life. I have to change the patch to patches now. Can you keep on in? Can you keep these on in the shower? She wants to know.
Oh, absolutely. Patches are meant to stay on in the shower if they're put on properly. I suppose the key to putting on your HRT patches is to put them onto dry skin without body lotion, without body oils or whatever. So to put them onto dry skin and let them, you know, sort of attach before you put body lotions on. For people that patches won't stay on, there is an estrogen gel and there is an estrogen spray now, so they can be alternatives for people.
And speaking of HRT patches, you know the big revolution that seems to have taken place in the last 2 years with people talking about menopause and a lot of the myths about HRT, the old methods being debunked. And I think the likes of Davina McCall has done women a great service.
And Joe Duffy.
And Joe Duffy. well, we can't be giving him praise. He's the opposition. Do you think that, have you seen a lot more women coming forward now looking for HRT and not being as afraid of it as they once were?
Absolutely. I suppose the key thing is they're coming forward to get information about menopause. And the big important message is that for some women, HRT may not be the answer, but there are plenty of other alternatives out there. I think there's a group of women that maybe missed the boat with HRT. Say, for example, we know that if you start HRT after 60, you might actually have more adverse effects on heart disease than positive effects. So we have to be very cautious with those women. So we have to look at all the other alternatives. And the big important message at the last conference I was at was that we don't go so overboard with HRT now that we go back into the same situation where we create problems. People need to do lifestyle changes as well. And it's HRT isn't for absolutely everybody.
Yeah, and it's not a panacea for all ills either.
And you won't ever get back, and I can say this with experience, you'll never get back to being 100% the way you were. But you'll get a lot of the way with it.
Yeah. And it should be said as well that a lot of women embrace the fact that they no longer have periods because a lot of women suffered with periods.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that we can use the Marina Coil and whatever as part of HRT can take the periods away for them. So there are a lot of benefits to looking at menopause in a holistic fashion.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, just before we go to break, just to remind people, this slot isn't just about menopause, it's about women's health, and Mary is an obstetrician gynecologist. She's happy to answer any queries you have. Maybe it's to do with fertility or periods or anything in the realm of women's health. Do send your questions in. We're on 083 300 3300. We'd love to hear from you, and we're back in just a moment.
Talk about
Women's Health Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic Rathas Tralee, specialists in fertility and menopause.
Now, Dr. Mary McCaffrey from the Scotia Clinic is here with us. And Mary, the next question comes in from a Killarney listener. She says, I'd like to ask Mary some advice regarding the pill. I'm age 48. I've been on Yasmin for years and I've just been advised to change to Cerzet. Just not used to the 28 days of taking tablets with no break. Just wondering, will my monthlies stop now? This is the first month after changing, or is there another pill similar for 21 days? So I'm not quite following that.
Yeah,
but does it
make
sense
okay.
to you?
And obviously I have to be very aware that some doctor has made this decision to make the swap over, and they might have their reasons. I suppose in general, Yasmin is an oestrogen-based pill, and as women get older, depending on what other risk factors they have, we would usually be trying to reduce the amount of oestrogen-based pills. So Cerazette is a different pill. It's a progestogen-only pill, and it's a 28-day cycle pill. So there isn't a 21-day equivalent of it. But she will, I would be expecting her to probably still get a period. But at her age, she may be perimenopausal and the periods may get a little bit more erratic. So Cerazette is a very appropriate pill.
Okay, Cerazette, I was saying it right. So she went from taking one every day to taking one 21 days and then days off.
Yeah. But a lot of the advice now, just for other people to know, the advice with the estrogen-based pills like Yasmin, Yasminel, all the other pills, is that you increase their efficacy by actually taking them only 4-day breaks. And very often we would have people who take no breaks because they don't want to have periods for a variety of reasons. So people don't have to take breaks on any pill.
Okay, okay. Now, this is a slightly different one. With a 57-year-old woman with vaginal itching, especially at night, can Mary suggest anything?
Okay. Well, one of the things that it's a big campaign that they have in England, we haven't quite got round to it here, is that we examine our breasts every month and we never look at down below in the vulval and vaginal area every month. So people can have itching because they have a skin disorder. They can have skin changes. They could have an irritation, inflammation, allergies. They could have thrush. And it can be vaginal dryness as well as women get older. So it's important for people to look and make sure there's no changes in the area. And obviously, if it's something sudden and new, maybe their GP should be get or GP nurse could have a look, just to make sure that it's nothing very significant. That's the most important thing to do. And then after that, it's about looking at allergies and other things.
Yeah, and would there be creams or anything like that that might help? Or
there would be, but I still think it's important to make sure there's nothing else happening first before you start masking it with creams.
Okay, very good. Lady is 51. She's wondering, is it normal to get a period while on, now you'll have to pronounce this for me, Xarelto, Xartelo or something, even though I have the Marina coil in place? I'm 51. My bloods show that I haven't entered the menopause. So I presume it's some form of contraception, Xarelto.
Okay. The Marina, you, for most people, will either reduce the periods or get rid of them completely, depending on various circumstances. So if something has changed out of nowhere and she has suddenly started having periods, she probably should get it checked out because of her age.
Okay, absolutely. Very interesting one here, Mary. We haven't had this asked to you before on the programme. 48-year-old woman, healthy weight, blood pressure and cholesterol, so she's in good shape. She said three trouble-free pregnancies in the past.
Okay.
She's wondering, is, am I too old to think about being a surrogate for my friend who can't have kids? So very healthy, but 48.
Okay. I would have said if she's very healthy and 48, there's probably no reason why she couldn't be a surrogate. For people who are doing surrogacy, obviously you're using, it's a dreadful phrase, but you're using the womb, you're almost giving the loan of your womb to someone. So if your womb is healthy, that's the main thing. And the embryos and from the sperm and egg have come from somewhere else, probably a younger woman. So she is not too old. She just needs to sit down. We would always say people should do counselling first to make sure that they have thought the decision through thoroughly. 48? No. Probably high-risk pregnancy when she gets pregnant. That's what she's got to realise. She will be the one pregnant. So at 48, she'll be a little bit more at risk of diabetes and high blood pressure. So she'd be falling into a high-risk pregnancy category, but not impossible.
Okay, that's a very comprehensive answer. We have a 46-year-old woman. She's had the Marina coil in for about 6 years and since September. And she says, how will I know if I'm having the menopause? I'm not sleeping at night and I'm putting on a lot of weight that I can't lose. what would Mary recommend? So there's kind of two questions in one.
Yeah. Well, when the marina is in, the marina is, for people who don't know a lot about it, it's actually a contraceptive device that's fitted into the womb with a hormone in it called progestogen. And it works as a contraceptive by thickening the cervical mucus so sperm don't get in and thinning the lining. So people still ovulate every month. So they will still go through a menopause probably with it. So it won't mask menopause completely. So she's probably, she sounds a bit perimenopausal, not sleeping, just things getting a little bit erratic. Yeah.
And the weight question, of course, if you could answer that, you'd be a millionaire.
Oh, I'd be such a millionaire. So the weight question, as we get older, our metabolism slows. As we get older from after 40, we start to lose muscle. Muscle burns calories and speeds up our metabolism. So you do put on weight if you're eating the same amount, exercising less, and you've less muscle. So it is kind of inevitable without lifestyle changes. But that can be reversed. And obviously, if someone's suddenly putting on weight, they need to look at maybe thyroid function. That's the kind of situation I'm getting at where a health check can be useful because you're getting your bloods done.
Okay.
And getting lifestyle advice.
Listener wants to know, if you're on HRT, are you on it for life? I'm on the patch for HRT and finding it great.
Okay. Well, we know that when people go on HRT, that we always counsel women that the thing we need to be most aware of is the small, and I use the word small in capital letters and bolded, risk of breast cancer. So we review people after 5 years and we look at their symptoms and see, do they still need it? Could they come and down and reduce a dose? And at 10 years, we make a big decision then. We do really do a big review at 10 years. Some people are on it for longer because they have, for quality of life purposes, they have to be. And sometimes they can get away with reducing the dose a little bit. And if there's a reason why they have to stop it, we look at what other alternatives are out there.
Okay. Mary wants to know, still on HRT, can it cause cancer later in life?
I've kind of mentioned that in the last question, that the biggest issue is the small risk of breast cancer that we always address, but people should be having regular mammograms, doing their monthly breast examinations themselves at home. And you can do breast checks as well. There's a breast score as well that you can do. Interestingly, what's come across my desk in the last couple of weeks is a blood test that's coming out from a lab in Australia that hopefully we'll have it now in Europe in the next couple of months, which can predict who is genetically at risk of various cancers. That'll be a huge
incredible
thing. That'll be incredible if it actually is something that is useful for us. It shouldn't cause cancer later in life if it's used appropriately under medical supervision.
Another very interesting one, listener says, my mother is 64. She's telling us all that she's out of the menopause and is refusing point blank to take HRT or any menopause vitamin. She claims she has sailed through it. But her daughters have gotten together and we can see that she hasn't sailed through it. It's impossible to be around her. Her mood is all over the place. She has angry outbursts and we find she's getting forgetful. Could this be linked to the menopause? Any help or advice would be great for dealing with this.
Okay, well, the woman feels she sailed through the menopause. She's obviously sailed through the menopause without any significant symptoms. And like I said earlier, we'd be very loath to start people on HRT after 60 because it does increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. It probably is worth looking at what she could, what they could take and what they could do alternatively. But the person themselves has to buy into the process also. And that's the important thing. It's very hard. You can take a horse to water, but you can't make them drink it. There are CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, is well proven now to be a good therapy as an alternative to HRT. And there are other medications we use as well that are not hormone-based that can be helpful for mood swings and symptoms. Very often find that people who had very bad PMS when they were younger are the people who will then have a lot of the anxiety and anger symptoms in menopause. So it would be nice from the family's point of view if the woman could be encouraged to talk to a healthcare professional. Doesn't have to be about taking hormones. It might be about looking at sort of more emotional based therapies, mental health therapies.
That's great advice. But of course, as you said, if she's not willing to even discuss it herself, there could be a bit of an uphill battle there. But Who knows? Lady Inners, who is 60, has the Marina coil in. She says it's in a long time. She has recently become separated and is wondering, will I get it removed? Should I get it removed?
Well, she doesn't need it, presumably, and it's probably not serving any function. She certainly should discuss that with her GP.
Yeah, and she's 60 as well, I suppose. Yeah. You know, and if she was using it as a contraception, presumably at 60.
Yeah.
Okay, a 49-year-old lady has an implant installed, which is due to come out next month. She's still sexually active and she's wondering, should she get a new one put in?
Well, the advice we give to women who are not menopausal is you need contraception right up to menopause, because we discussed earlier about people having little rebound bursts of fertility and getting pregnant late in life. So if she's not menopausal, the advice would be she needs contraception for at least another 2 years at the very least. So she needs some form of contraception.
Listener says, I am perimenopausal and I get a lot of migraines and nausea. Would HRT help?
It may. Women who have to be more a little bit more careful with migraine, because the migraines with aura can cause problems for women who are put on oestrogen. But certainly someone who's suddenly getting a lot more headachy can find that HRT can help them.
And we should acknowledge as well that I think since the start of the new year, the price of HRT has come down, hasn't it? It was brought in the budget.
Yeah, I think the VAT, what is that the VAT rates have been reduced, which is important. And where that comes into its own is that often the patches and the sprays, which were the oestrogen that goes through your skin, they were often quite expensive for people. And they're the ones we like people to be on because they're safer from a cholesterol point of view, high blood pressure, clotting, whatever. So yeah, they've come down a little bit. And we've also got to acknowledge, while we're on the subject of women's health, about the changes in free contraception as well. And we also have to sort of make people aware that the rollout of menopause clinics around the country, menopause hubs for complex cases, is really sort of up and running now.
Yeah, okay. Those are all very positive steps.
They're all really positive steps.
Yeah, very good. Mary, people can find you at the Scotia Clinic, of course, and you're very active online as well. You have a Facebook page and an Instagram.
Instagram, and we try our best. And, you know, we often do we do talks for groups of people in various community organisations. I think we're due to go to South Kerry in Carrasaveen, Waterville direction, somewhere in the next couple of months. And we're going to one of the secondary schools in Killarney in February as well. So we're
to chat to the young girls.
To the young ones, because I think the importance of getting healthy from a very young age is really good.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Fantastic idea. Listen, we let you go, Mary. We've kept you over time, actually, but that's because there's so many questions that have come in for you, which just goes to prove that the slot is growing in popularity. So thank you for answering all those questions, as complex as some of them were. We'll chat to you again next month.
Like I was doing my membership exam again.
We kept you on through your paces. Thanks a million, Dr. Mary McCaffrey from the Scotia Clinic. We'll take a break, folks.
Women's Health Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic, Rathas Tralee. Specialists in fertility and menopause.
Okay, and a warm welcome to Dr. Mary McCaffrey from the Scotia Clinic. Mary, thank you for coming in to us. And we decided, following some feedback, that we might talk a bit about contraception this month. And at the outset, I presume there's a lot of new types of contraception in recent years. And is it something that's always changing? Are there always new types coming on the market?
We go through phases, Deirdre. First of all, I want to apologise. I'm all snuffly. I hope people will actually be able to understand me. We go through phases where nothing new might happen for a while, and then all of a sudden a couple of new things will happen together. I suppose the biggest thing that's happened in the country is the government scheme for free contraception for women from 17 to 26 years of age, which is a really positive thing. So that means that any person in that age category is able to avail of free contraception, free consultation with their GPs to get the contraception prescribed, if it's a coil to put in or whatever. So that's a really big thing, because it makes it an affordable option for people. So that's one thing that's happened. The other new thing that's happened recently is the guidelines for the Marina coil has changed as well. So where before the marina for younger people, it was changed every 5 years, that's now moved to 8 years. And for women over 45, well, it's been that way for a while, it's now 10 years. So a couple of changes in that, which again means less cost for people who are older getting the marina in. So that was another good thing. And there's a new copper coil out as well, which has a lovely girly name called Ballerine. So that's going to be like a little kind of a beaded, kind of almost like a little necklace of copper beads that will be fitted into the uterus. So it probably makes it's a much smaller copper coil as well. So for women who don't want hormones in their womb, that'll be an option. So yeah, three things that have happened quite quickly together, which is good.
Mm. And back in the day, there was a lot of people who weren't very happy with the pill and they found they had all kinds of side effects. Has the pill, improved and been...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose we should actually even change the word we use. We always use the word pill, but I think a lot of people aren't aware that the hormones that are in the pill, which is a contraceptive that prevents you ovulating, are also now available in a patch and in a vaginal ring that you put into the vagina as well. So it comes in different ways. And where those options, say the patch or the ring, would be more appropriate. If someone's taking a pill, if they've any problems with their tummy or their gut, it will often interfere with how effective the pill will be as a contraceptive. So if someone, say, had vomiting and diarrhea, someone had chronic celiac, maybe Crohn's disease, they mightn't absorb the pill as well, which would make it a less effective contraceptive. And we can swap over to maybe a patch or a ring. It also means less hormones into the system. So different things. The other thing as well, when we talk about pills and hormonal contraception, we use them for other things besides contraception. So when someone comes in for a consult, we can often dovetail the two things together. So say, for example, if you had someone with very bad premenstrual syndrome, we might find that particular hormones would be better for them. Some pills would be better than others. The same with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Some pills might help their symptoms more than others. So there's just such an array of things out there that there should be a contraceptive that suits everybody. And they're so much more effective now. And I suppose the other thing I should have mentioned, which is kind of not new, but people aren't aware of it, if you reduce the gap of time that you take in your pill or your patch or your ring, instead of a 7-day break, if you go down to a 4-day break, you reduce the risk of, pregnancies on those hormones, because you're reducing the time that there's no hormone in your bloodstream. And in fact, people can take pills back to back without any break. A lot of people who do that maybe would be dancers, swimmers, sports people who don't want to have bleeding on their week off it. So okay, they're all options.
And is it a bad idea if you do that indefinitely so you don't have any periods at all?
There's no downside to that. In fact, we'd use it for treating endometriosis, for example, would be one thing. Or maybe I see a lot of girls now with additional needs, and that's something I would always like to support. People who have girls with maybe autism or Down syndrome who really struggle with the whole hormones of puberty, and very often we'll put them on a pill back to back without any break, or put a coil in for them. It's no downside to it.
Okay. Do your contraceptive needs change as you age, Mary?
Yes, I suppose. The first thing is just take the hormonal contraception. First of all, if someone is older, traditionally we thought that the pill was more dangerous. It is probably more risky for certain groups of women. So someone who's older, maybe is a smoker, maybe is overweight and has a risk of stroke or cardiovascular disease, then we would look at changing that for them. And I suppose the reality as well is when people are older, they don't want to get pregnant a lot of the time. So we'd use something that's more effective, maybe like you put in a marina coil and it's in for 10 years and that's the end of it. It'll take you straight through to menopause. And people's periods might change. They might have fibroids. They might have just different gynae needs, and the contraceptive need would change with that.
Are all types of the pill equally effective, or are some more reliable than others?
Well, the answer to that should be that we pick the pill that'll be effective for that particular person. So, that it should be tailored for that person. Nowadays, the pills are so low in the dose of hormones in them from a safety point of view that they're probably, if you don't take them properly, going to reduce your pregnancy, your failure rate. So in general, anyone who takes a pill effectively, properly and abides by the rules, it's 90%, 99% effective. But in reality, not everybody does. So it probably comes down to 91. So the lower hormone ones, the other thing is some pills will interfere with certain drugs that you're on. Anticonvulsants for epilepsy would be a common one. So that's why we might look at different doses for those, or really swap a type of contraception and not use the pill at all.
Mm. We often heard as well the expression, someone had their tubes tied. Is that... does that still happen, or is that...
Well, absolutely, yeah, it does. Yeah. I'm not sure why, because getting a tubal ligation is an operation, so it's an anaesthetic, it's an operation, it has the risks of surgery to go with it. I can't remember the last time I did a tubal ligation, to be honest, bar doing it maybe at C-section, because it is an operation for people. And there are so many more effective contraceptives out there that any time someone comes in with that consultation, you've got to sit back and look and say, well, what else can we offer you that's equally as effective and doesn't have that surgical risk? And of course, we have to say that male sterilisation in the form of vasectomy is probably safer than female, because there's no major anaesthetic involved, there's no trip to theatre, it's a lesser surgery, and it's probably more effective as a contraceptive. But people who are looking at sterilisation always have to be 100,000% sure in their minds they're not going to want to be pregnant again. And the reality is, relationships change nowadays, and the number of people I see older who go into a new relationship have had their tubes tied, and then it's just going to be more challenging for them if they want to have a baby.
Not impossible, though.
Not impossible, because they end up doing IVF or something. But that's why, if there's something as effective as sterilisation, maybe leave it till you're really, really sure it's the right thing to do.
Yes, not something you do on a whim anyway. Mary, we'll take a quick break. We've got some questions for you. And if anybody has any query for Mary about women's health, specifically we're talking today about contraception, send your query in to us by phoning Padraig on 066 712 3666, and you can also text or indeed WhatsApp on 083 300 3300. More women's health after these.
Women's Health Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic Rathas Tralee, specialists in fertility and menopause.
Okay, Mary, we have a question for you from a Killarney listener, and she wants some advice about the pill. She's 48. She's been on Yasmin for years and has just been advised to change to Cerzet. She says she's just not used to 28 days of taking tablets with no break. And she's wondering, will her period stop now? This is her first month after changing it, or is there another pill similar to Cerazette that she need only take for 21 days?
No, Cerazette is what we call a progestogen-only pill, so it doesn't have oestrogen in it. And it's understandable her GP has probably taken her off oestrogen because of her age. So Cerazette works differently, so you take it every day. I don't see why she... It's the same as me telling someone on a 21-day pill, take it back to back. It's the same thing.
Yeah, she says she's not used to taking 28 days of tablets, and she's used to kind of having a period, which isn't really a period, but a bleed.
She might still have a period with Cerazette, so I wouldn't be too worried about it. It's safer for her, to be honest, at 48.
Okay, very good. Now, another one from a listener. If I get pregnant while using a hormone contraceptive, will it harm my baby?
That's a tough one, because obviously if someone does get pregnant on a hormone, it probably wouldn't, to be honest, and people do get pregnant on the pill, and the hormones are so low dose now, but it defeats the whole purpose of it. So it gives me a chance to remind people that there are lots of apps out there to remind you about your contraceptive and taking it every day. So there's apps for taking the pill that you just put onto your phone and you get a little ping to remind you, apps for every type of contraceptive you could possibly need. I'd be kind of wondering why someone is worried they'll get pregnant, so they maybe should go back and have a chat with their doctor again.
I would imagine it's very seldom someone
very
on the
seldom.
Pill would get pregnant.
Very seldom.
Yeah, okay. A listener says, I was told I can't take the morning after pill for a third time. Why is this? That's the emergency contraception.
It's the emergency contraceptive, yeah. I suppose there isn't a strict rule that you can't take it. I suppose we'd prefer people weren't. And it's interesting, I had this conversation with a pharmacist this morning when I was telling them I was doing this show, that if someone is getting to the point where they need the emergency contraceptive for a third time, they need to be going to their doctor to talk about what's wrong. Why are they constantly needing emergency contraception? If they're forgetting to take a pill, maybe another method would suit them better. Maybe they should have a coil in. So I think that's the message that's probably been given to them. Do stop taking the emergency contraception as a contraceptive.
Yeah, okay. It was never intended for that.
No. Yeah. No, it's not good for your body anyway. It'll mess up your cycle and everything.
Now, we have a few that have come in that are related to women's health, but not necessarily about contraception. And this one is particularly interesting and very worrying for the person in question. This listener says, our 17-year-old daughter, 17, has started wetting the bed at night in the last few weeks out of the blue. Had a urine sample checked in the lab and nothing there, just a bit of bacteria. She said she can't seem to hold on until she goes to the bathroom. And because of this, she's now drinking nothing all day at school because she's afraid she'll wet herself. Any idea what could be going on?
Okay. Sometimes stress can cause people to become bedwetters, but it doesn't sound like that's what it is. It sounds that for whatever reason her bladder is a little bit overactive and irritated. Perhaps it's an infection, but she sounds like she needs to see a doctor. She probably needs to see either a urologist probably would be her first port of call, and a good maybe women's health physio could help with that as well, but she needs the investigations first.
Yeah, so her first port of call after her GP would be a referral
probably
to
a referral to a urologist.
Okay. Yeah. Have you come across that before, someone of that age?
It's a bit unusual a little bit unusual.
Okay, so maybe get it investigated further. On a similar vein, but a much older person this time, a 77-year-old female says when she gets up in the morning, she nearly wets herself quite frequently. And she's wondering, would hormone treatment help her? And if so, what would you suggest?
Okay. As you get older, the bladder becomes more inflamed from the menopausal changes over the years. You've had no estrogen for a long time. So again, that sounds a little bit like an overactive bladder. Maybe her bladder capacity isn't as good as usual. It's probably the same port of call, just to make sure there's nothing wrong. And then a very good women's health continence physio could maybe work with them. And yes, we would often use with vaginal oestrogen to assist in the continence physio program.
Okay. Another listener is Amy. She emailed us and she says, I'm in perimenopause, but I've awful joint pain, especially early morning stiffness. Where could I go to get help with this?
Okay. Actually, joint pain is something that people are mentioning more often as one of their menopause symptoms. But one of the issues always has to be to make sure that you don't just write it off as menopause and ignore something else that could be going on, like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis or whatever. So if their doctor did the inflammatory markers and did a bit of menopause check as well, they could then be referred on to rheumatology. We have a new rheumatologist in Scotia, actually, Dr. Sebastian, who's a consultant in Limerick and has joined us. So he has a lot of interest in women with joint pain and things like that. So I think it's really down to the GP to try and figure out what might be the right pathway to go.
We have a lady who's 30, Mary. She's using the bar type of contraception and has stage 3 endometriosis. And she's wondering, would you have any advice for her? What's the bar type of contraception?
It's called Implanon. It's a little implant in your arm of progestogen. Well, if her endometriosis is playing up and the Implanon isn't maybe stopping her bleeding, she probably needs a review, to be honest, of that, because there might be something else rather than the Implanon that might help. It probably needs to be reviewed by a gynaecologist who specialises in endometriosis, just to see. It's a difficult one now when I don't have history for scans and everything.
There. Okay. Yeah. listener says, if you have the coil in for 5 years, is that one good for 8 years? As Mary said at the start, that the coil is now good for 8 years.
Oh, yeah, it probably is, but I would check in with the person who put it in just to be sure if nothing has changed with the physical coil that was put in for her 5 years ago. It's still the same coil I'd be putting in for someone next week, so she should be able to extend it for 3 years. Just needs to check with her GP and what coil it is, because there are different coils. There's a Kylina, there's a Jadis, there's a Marina.
Okay. Now, this next question is very interesting. It's a lady who already has four boys. She's 39 and her last child was 6 years ago. So she has four boys and she's desperate for a girl. She's 39. The problem is that she hemorrhaged very badly on her last labour 6 years ago. And she says they had to act fast to get my baby out. I'm just wondering, will this happen again? I have no girls, just four boys, and I'm desperate.
And if she gets pregnant again, she might have another boy.
That's
the reality.
Yeah.
Unless she's gone down the road of IVF and gender selection. I suppose the issue is going to be why she bled in the first place. And again, back to the issue that I don't know her history. I think for people like that, I often say, why not sit down with your obstetrician, review your notes, see what caused it, see is it something that's likely to recur, and then you can sit back and say, is it safe to have another pregnancy? It usually is. It's just a matter of trying to figure out what happened.
Okay, and 39, she's still okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Listener says, when on HRT, should one have the estrogen and progesterone levels checked every so often to ensure absorption?
Not necessarily, and the guidelines would say that you don't need to. What I would say, though, is that if we see someone who is on whatever dose of HRT they're on and they're still symptomatic, just sometimes we would check the levels to see do they seem to be absorbing them. It's more about the estrogen for the symptoms. The progesterone is there to protect the lining of the womb from overthickening and eventually becoming malignant. So that one is not going to be measurable in blood, and probably if they're worried about that, an ultrasound scan could help, but it isn't something that would be routine practice.
Now, this next one there's a funny pronunciation here. You'll have to help me with it. Lady says, I'm 47 and I wanted to go on HRT, but my GP was slow to put me on it. So they changed my pill from Yasmin to, and this is where I can't pronounce it, QLARAFWELs.
Yeah.
That should be enough should that be enough hormones for me? Well, I think their doctor told them that should be enough hormones for me.
Okay.
And they're wondering, would Mary agree with that?
Oh, what age is she again?
47.
47. It probably should be, yeah. But at 47 and she's perimenopausal, maybe the transdermal estrogen with patch or spray or something might be a little bit safer from the blood clotting point of view, but that's obviously a conversation to have with her GP again.
Yeah, of course it depends. I mean, does she obviously wants a contraception and a hormone dose.
Correct.
As well in,
yeah,
one.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so that's a little bit more complicated. Another listener says, do progesterone tablets cause weight gain while on HRT?
I think what happens more on HRT that people associate the weight gain with it is as you get older, your metabolism slows. So if your metabolism is slower, you're going to put on weight, and it's the midlife weight gain. And we try to counteract that by looking at resistance training, diet, building your muscles, because muscles will burn calories. So the progesterone on its own doesn't really. Sometimes can make you feel a bit bloated, and sometimes we can just adjust the kind of progesterone that we use for HRT. So that would be probably the answer to that question. Can I just go back to that previous question? That was something we should have addressed earlier when you asked me, do your contraceptives needs change? That woman who's 47 needs contraceptive cover for at least 2 years if she's perimenopausal anyway. So the Clara is providing that for her, but it might be that she needs to review her whole menopause status. So that maybe is the consultation she needs to be having with her GP.
Very good. Before we finish up with you, Mary, you wanted to mention a forthcoming meeting, is that right?
Oh, yeah. Last month when I was in, I mentioned that we were going to Waterville after a big long absence before COVID to do a women's health meeting. And I didn't have a date. I didn't have a date fixed. And of course, I was hardly out the door when people were emailing the clinic. It's the 11th of March in Waterville at 11 o'clock. It's a Saturday morning. I'm hoping some of the team will come with me and we'll be able to stay around afterwards to talk to people.
And the venue?
the venue, oh, I can't pronounce it now, Tig Amargan.
Yeah, that's it.
And just one last little thing, with so much on contraception today, if you go into your smartphone app, the World Health Organization have a contraception tool. It's actually really good. And you can go in and you can put in bits and pieces of your history and it'll come up with a few recommendations for contraception for you. So someone who wants to do a bit of groundwork before they go to a doctor, that can be nice.
Good. And of course, you can be found at the Scotia Clinic here in Tralee if anyone wants to make an appointment or get in touch with you. You're still there.
Thank you.
Mary, just a lovely compliment for you before we finish up. A texter says, I absolutely love the addition of the women's health slot to your show. It's so informative and interesting listening to Dr. Mary.
Thank you.
There you go. You have a fan out there. Mary, thanks a million for that. And we'll chat to you again next month, all going well. We'll take a break, folks.
Women's Health Matters on Talkabout. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic, Rathas Tralee. Specialists in fertility and menopause.
Now, a warm welcome to Dr. Mary McCaffrey from the Scotia Clinic. How are you, Mary?
Hi, Deirdre. I am just fine. A bit cold and chilly out there, but fine.
But other than that, we're all good. Mary, you're going to talk to us a little bit this month about women who might, well, I suppose women and men who might have difficulties conceiving. And straight away I was thinking, I almost said women, but of course we always presume the onus is on the woman and it takes two people to make a baby.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, that is so true because people who are trying for a baby come to us in all shapes and forms. These days we would see more women coming forward now who may not have a partner and know that realistically in the future they're not going to find a partner, and they decide to go it alone and have a baby, maybe using a sperm donor from a sperm bank. We're seeing same-sex guys deciding to have a baby with a surrogate. So yeah, fertility is coming in a wide, wide variety of ways, and it has changed so much in the last few years.
And you can go to the Scotia Clinic in either of those scenarios you mentioned and get the ball rolling, so to
Absolutely.
Speak.
Absolutely. And you should be able to go to every fertility clinic in Ireland in all of those scenarios, because this is one of the big things that the government are rolling out at the moment, is fertility services for people. And we see people in our hospital clinic and in other clinics coming forward saying they want to have a baby. They may not be able to avail of the treatment, say sperm donation isn't available within the public system, but at least they can get their tests done, and then we can give them options about where they go. Do they stay in this country? Do they go abroad? Whatever.
Okay, so let's just take that one scenario there that you mentioned initially. A woman who isn't in a relationship with a man wants to have a baby. What kind of options would you typically discuss with her?
Two women who are in a relationship.
Or two women who are in a relationship, yeah.
So I suppose in that situation, I suppose the basic thing I think that's important to say is, for women, we would really like that they would be coming about their fertility issues at a much younger age. Women are born with the amount of eggs they have for all of their lives. So you're born with your number of eggs and they deteriorate over time. And like anything else, as you get older, the quality won't be as good. So There is a starting point, but realistically, you know, women are coming to us when they're older. So if two women came to us who want to have a baby, or a woman on her own comes to us who wants to have a baby, we would work through her history, look at her fitness and her medical history, and then the option for her would be to look at doing either IUI or IVF with sperm donation. That would be the usual option for a couple like that.
And I know you mentioned that that's not funded on the public system, but it is, but it is privately.
Yeah.
And how do you go about the selection process then, or with the sperm donation, or how does that work? Because it's a whole new world for many people.
It's a whole new world out there. And if someone was going ahead and doing, say, sperm donation with IUI insemination, they access every clinic would have a sperm bank associated with it, and they get into a database and they get guidance from the clinicians in their clinic as to how they would pick their donor. It might be based on, say, obviously ethnicity and colour. For example, someone asked me today, would I be able to get them a black donor because they're African? So that would be something that would be looked at. And obviously there are certain medical aspects to it that we would look at as well. I do think as well that people often think that when they're going abroad and they go into forums on social media and pick clinics abroad, I do think it's important for people to realise that fertility is very well regulated within the EU.
And I think at the time we think it's a bit of a nuisance, the level of regulation, but it makes patient safety huge. So I think staying within the EU network is actually important as well.
Are you seeing a rise in the number of women going down the route of sperm donation?
We're seeing, yeah, more women. We're also seeing more women going down the route of egg freezing. And because they're not in a relationship, they're not sure when they will be in a relationship, they're coming to look at egg freezing a little bit more. What I would say to people is that, as again, with back to the quality of older eggs versus younger eggs, if people are going to do egg freezing, the time to do it is really when you're under 35. And sometimes people get into a situation where a clinic might encourage them to do egg freezing when they're older. We can assess egg quantity based on blood tests and scans. And very often women who freeze eggs when they're much older, say 38, 39, 40, those eggs may not survive a thaw in the future. So it could be a situation where the money mightn't be as well spent as they could. So it's where professional advice, I suppose, comes into it.
Now, another scenario you mentioned is, we'll say, a same-sex male couple. What are their options if they want to go down the route of parenthood?
Parenthood is usually a surrogacy, and the two fathers will decide which one is going to be the donor of the sperm. And in general, within the EU, there are no clinics anywhere within the EU at the moment offering that service to men. So most people are going outside the EU. Ironically, that's now Britain most of the time. When Britain were within the EU, that service wasn't necessarily available. So most of the guys we see are going to the UK or probably maybe Mexico or the States. Canada would be another big country. Actually, and I forgot to even think about it, there is a meeting on in Dublin on the 26th of March for couples who are looking at surrogacy and egg donation within Europe. So that would be a meeting for anybody who is in that scenario that could be worth coming to.
Okay. And again, are you seeing same-sex male couples inquiring about going down that route?
Yeah, it's becoming more common. What's becoming also more common, I suppose, is couples, both men and women, who are getting into new relationships as they get older. So it's not unusual for us to see couples now, maybe in 39, 40, where they've come into a new relationship together. They may have children in their previous relationships, but they want a baby together. Or it might be that, say, one of them has a baby already and the other person doesn't, and it's becoming very important for them to have a baby together. I would say, as you get older, if you're thinking these in along the any lines of fertility or trying for a baby, to come as soon as you can for investigations, because your chances of getting pregnant after 35 lessen. They're not impossible, but your options narrow a little bit, so always doing your investigations when you're as young as possible.
Okay, so for a couple, we'll say a male-female couple, and let's pick a scenario. They're trying for a number of years. They're now in their late 30s. Nothing is happening. They're a bit concerned. What kind of things do you explore with them typically?
So when we meet a couple, any couple of whatever age, we would take a detailed history from them. We'd be looking at, you know, previous surgeries. Maybe someone's had surgery on their ovaries in the past, or someone's, and it might affect their ovarian reserve. They might have had a ruptured appendix or a pelvic infection in the past, so the tubes might be at risk of being blocked. On the guy's side of things, maybe he had mumps when he was younger, maybe he had a quite common undescended testis when they were younger. And back in the day, 20, 40 years ago, people wouldn't have thought of the importance of doing surgery when they're babies. And it sometimes lapses a little bit. So we would do a semen analysis and look at that, look at their lifestyles. Lifestyle is a huge part of it, getting people as healthy as possible to be in a healthy zone, as ideal a weight as possible, not smoking, not vaping, looking at if they're on medications, could they be impinging on fertility. So it's quite a detailed history. And then we do the tests quite quickly. And like you said earlier, when I was a young doctor, the woman had the investigations, and it was only when everything else was normal that the guys were dragged in to do their tests. We kind of do them in tandem now. So within 6 weeks, you should be able to get all of your tests done.
Yeah, and the guys are probably okay with it as well.
Actually, what's interesting, in the last couple of years, we're seeing guys coming forward to do their own test.
Yeah.
Separately from their partner, just ringing up and saying, can I book a semen analysis before we you know, go down the road of going to our GP.
Slightly controversial question now, Mary, but I think it has to be addressed. The upward age limit, I know that can be a very tricky one and a very hard one, but yeah. I presume there has to be a cut-off point for a woman in terms of what you're willing to encourage her to do to get pregnant. Okay. Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, you are. You're absolutely making sense. So I suppose we know that as you get older, there are more risks. The first is the risk to the pregnancy that, you know, we know that Down syndrome and any other chromosomal anomalies are at more high risk as you get older. So people have to think on that. And I always say to them, you know, if you did get pregnant and you were in that position, how would you manage that scenario? Because people mightn't have even thought about, oh gosh, if I had a baby with Down syndrome, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a baby with Down syndrome, would I be able to cope? Would we be able to cope as a family? And they're and a lot of, we try and encourage people where the scenarios are difficult to meet with a fertility counsellor. We have a fabulous fertility counsellor in our clinic, Tara O'Connor. So we try and get them to meet and tease out the issues, because sometimes when they do that, facilitated by a counsellor, they might think differently about it. So they're, perhaps they might decide that they would do IVF and do genetic testing of embryos, so they're only putting healthy embryos back, which reduces the risk of something going wrong. It might be that egg donor is the route that they would have to travel. It could be lots of different scenarios, but counselling, and it is now a regulation in the country under legislation, that if anyone is using sperm donor or an egg donor, that counselling is compulsory now. And I think that's good, but I think it should be something people do anyway, because simple things might come up about, if we have a baby with a sperm donor, how are we going to tell that child where it came from? Will we tell that child? They mightn't have thought of any of those issues. For surrogacy, I suppose the upper limit now within Europe, Greece would be our go-to country for surrogacy. They've now increased the age to 54. Which, when you think about it, is really to be starting off a pregnancy and rearing a child at 54. You're going to be 64 when that child's making its confirmation. It's, you know, it's a lot of things people need to think about. But at the end of the day, you can only give information to people. And
so that's surrogacy. So
yeah.
Upward limit there of about 50.
52 to 54 yeah, would okay. be in most countries.
But in terms of trying to get pregnant yourself without surrogacy, the upper
okay.
limit there
the
would
upper
be...
limit, as you, at 35, your fertility does take quite a dip. But it's still not going to be, you know, impossible. And after 40, it really is, you've probably even in 10% chance of pregnancy in anyone cycle with IVF or with any natural treatments. So yeah, that is the issue, and that is why the younger you are, the better. But there are newer treatments coming on all the time. Some clinics offer a treatment called platelet-rich plasma, which is taking your own blood, injecting it into ovaries to see can they encourage regeneration, to get more eggs. Some clinics will do two IVF cycles back to back to try and get more eggs. So there are lots and lots of options out there. It's just to sit down and explore them.
Yeah, and it's so important to talk to the woman as well about is she absolutely sure she wants to go down this route?
Absolutely.
We'll take a quick break, Mary. It's 19 minutes past two. I know you have a few events coming up that you want to let us know about as well. Indeed, we have some questions for you too. 083 300 3300 if you've anything to ask Mary. We'll be back with...
Women's Health Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic Rathas Tralee. Specialists in fertility and menopause.
Now, Dr. Mary McCaffrey is with me. Mary, we have some questions for you. They're not necessarily to do with our topic today, but we're quite happy to answer anything in the realm of women's health. But before that, you want to tell us about an event coming up in Waterville.
Yeah, so tomorrow, because this event has been in the making for nearly a year, waiting for COVID to settle down and everything, we have a women's health probably more around the menopause age group tomorrow in Waterville. As of this morning at 9 o'clock, there were 5 places left because it's quite a small little lecture theatre. So just to let people know, that's on in Tig, go on, you say
Tig Amargan,
tomorrow at 11 o'clock.
Is it yourself?
Oh, it's 11 o'clock, myself and a physio from Cara Savina doing it together.
Brilliant.
And we have joyfully got the luxury of having the Sam Maguire Cup coming into Scotia on the 1st of April with some of the senior football team. We always try and get it in for the kids who've come through our clinic when we have a cup around. But most importantly, this year we're going to do a sensory hour for children with additional needs who might find a big crowd overwhelming. So people can find out about that through the clinic.
Okay, and just for the Waterville event, can you turn up or do you need to book it?
I know as of this morning they had only about 5 places left, so I probably would say maybe just not turn up, maybe ring them today.
Ring Tech Elmergan, yeah, and find out more. Okay, Mary, we move on with some questions and we're back to the subject of heavy periods again, and this came in via email. A lady says her 15-year-old daughter suffers with nausea twice a month during her period and when she's ovulating. It's causing her to miss school. The sickness in the morning time can often lead to her throwing up. It improves, however, as the day goes on, but can return the following morning. We recently visited our GP who put her on Jasmine, a pill. Yeah. She only started on it this week, but I'm just wondering if Mary could suggest any other ideas.
That would be exactly what I would have said to do.
Yeah, so she only started on it this week. Is there anything else at all that...
What the Yasminel will do is, because it's a contraceptive pill, it'll stop her ovulating. So the first bit of nausea she's probably getting is at ovulation time in the middle of the month, so that'll stop that. And then around her period time, it's again the release of prostaglandins during a period. So I think they need to give it a month or two to see how it's working. It should certainly get rid of the middle of the month one, and at the end of the month then she could probably even take Nurofen with it as she feels her period's coming on. She could also probably go back to back from one pack to another without a break, just to give her and she would have no period. Might take a little bit of time to settle down because they do get spotting and bleeding, but she could go from one pill to another without taking any breaks.
That's awful to have the nausea twice in the month.
It is, that's unusual. You don't
Poor girl.
That so often, yeah.
Yeah, that's awful. Well, look, hopefully things will settle down for her. Okay, thank you, Mary, for that. We have a 55-year-old lady who's now in menopause for a year, eats healthy, takes exercise, normal BMI. She says, I can deal with the classic symptoms like hot flushes, but in my late 40s, I started getting issues with digestion, bowel, sluggishness and bloating. Then the joint stiffness, the no energy fatigue joined the list. Then over the last 4 years, I've had anxiety, low motivation, waking for good during the night, and worst of all, hair loss. I'm not idle and everything is an ordeal, even the stuff that used to be fun. I feel like I'm really struggling. My GP has never suggested that these were perimenopause related. Thank God for recent media focus and for Google. Should I consider HRT, though I am nervous/apprehensive? Ken Mayer, listener.
Well, I don't think she should be nervous or apprehensive. I think there are so many options out there for women, and her GP can do just a full risk assessment on her and see whether there's any reason she can't be on HRT. She sounds like somebody that would really, really benefit from being on HRT.
Yeah, and can I say, I'm all for HRT. I'm on it myself and swear by it. And you know, women have suffered in silence for long enough, haven't they?
Yeah, and it's amazing when you put someone on HRT and they come back in a couple of months, and so many, they may not be perfect and all their symptoms may not go, but it does make a difference.
Yeah.
And then sometimes for anxiety, if that doesn't completely settle on HRT, there's a lot of research out there now to show that cognitive behavioural therapy added in within, say, after 3 or 4 months of trying HRT can help the anxiety side of things. But often the anxiety comes about because people are just starting to doubt themselves and wondering if they're going to be able to function.
This is it, exactly. And the brain fog and everything.
Absolutely,
and you start thinking you're going mad.
Yeah,
this is it. Okay, well, good luck to that lady in Kinmare, and I hope she gets sorted. Another listener says, is it normal to get stabbing pain in your breast during the menopause?
It can be, yeah, because that's a hormonal change. Hopefully that person is also having their mammograms, and hopefully they're wearing good fitting bras, because having your bra the right size is important, so the wires aren't cutting in or whatever. Evening primrose oil, starflower oil, great for breast tenderness.
Okay, very good. And another listener says, how can you best reduce estrogen in your body? Okay, I'm not sure what that's...
I don't quite understand that question. I'm not sure why someone would want to reduce estrogen in their body.
Am I saying it right? Maybe it's estrogen, E-S-T-R-O-G-E-N.
Oh, that's okay.
Or it is estrogen,
so,
yeah.
I'm sorry, if the person wanted to maybe do a more detailed question, we could come to it next month.
Yeah, maybe if they might send it in to us again and we can come back to it. Mary, just to come back to the whole issue of struggling with fertility, I suppose if people were to take away a number of just sharp points from today, it would be that, you know, don't delay, get in to a clinic like yourself and get things investigated. Don't keep putting it in the long finger.
I think the delay thing is something people often regret later. What we would say normally is if a young, healthy couple, early 30s, trying for a baby, it's reasonable to try for 1 year, and if they're not pregnant at the end of a year, to have investigations. If there was something more complicated about them, say the girl had a history of PCOS or she'd had endometriosis or surgery in the past, maybe do the investigations a little bit sooner. But certainly for women over 35, 36, I would say do your investigations sooner. It might be that you decide not to have treatment. It might be that you decide that you don't want to go ahead with something, but at least do your investigations. Lifestyle is so important, being a healthy weight, taking your folic acid, and stress. We're seeing that in a few couples that I would have said to do some mindfulness. There's a really good app called Fertile Mind that we use, said they didn't realise until they started it
how stressed they were.
Reflexology, again, very helpful. We would have, there's a few very good reflexologists in the county who have an interest in fertility, acupuncture, lots of options out there for people.
Just one final question. I'll squeeze this one in. It came in late. A listener wants to know, she's 52. She says, would Mary advise me to change my coil because mine is nearly 7 years old and I'm on HRT patches?
Okay. I presume she's talking about a Mirena coil. Any Mirena that's put in after 45 is licensed for contraceptive use for 10 years. But the license for Mirena for HRT is 5 years. So if it's in 7 years, it depends when she started the HRT. It would sound to me like it probably does need to be changed.
Yeah, okay. Just a final humorous comment to end the slot with Mary. A texter says she's really enjoying the show and this slot in particular. And she says, as a woman going through the menopause at the moment, the only answer to all this is to come back in the next life as a man.
Interesting.
Not sure if I'd fancy that.
No, I don't think so.
Despite everything, it's still
don't think so either.
It's still good to be a woman. Pat doesn't agree next door, but anyway. he's overruled. He says he lives with three women, so he's overruled. Mary, thank you very much. And of course, people can contact you via the Scotia Clinic here in Tralee. Appreciate that.
Yeah,
we'll chat next month.
Yeah.
We'll take a break, folks. Lots more time for this.
Women's Health Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic, Rathas Tralee. Specialists in fertility and menopause.
Now, Mary McCaffrey is with us from the Scotia Clinic, and you're very welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Deirdre. It's a lovely sunny day.
Beautiful sunny day. And you want to kick off this month by acknowledging that it is World Health Day today.
It is World Health Day today, and the theme for today is Health for All. Which obviously is important that everyone should have equal access to health. It's also coinciding with an issue close to our hearts, which is also Autism Awareness Month. And I thought it would be nice to acknowledge that families who have girls with autism often find the adolescence phase quite a challenge in their lives, because young girls with autism often struggle with change in their lives and the arrival of body changes, hormone changes, periods. Periods can be a huge trigger for people to get quite stressed when they're on the autism spectrum. And then that impacts out into the families, because they might have brothers, they struggle with periods and the blood and all of that. And more parents are coming forward now and saying, we need our daughters to be seen by a gynecologist. What have you to offer us in terms of, you know, providing services for girls who are in pain? They don't understand why they're in pain. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think there is nothing to stop people having their girls seen by a doctor and appropriate care being given.
Okay, and so is there specialised help available for girls going through puberty who are on the autism spectrum?
Well, there isn't specialised care, I suppose. You wouldn't call it specialised care, but for example, someone might come in and say, my daughter just cannot cope with the idea that she bleeds every month and she's, you know, getting distressed and pulling down her underwear, and then everyone's embarrassed if it happens out in the open. So often we would look at whether the birth control pill, whether the Mirena coil or something is an option for that. So there are different things that can trigger it, and often mood changes as well. So someone who's quite prone to sensitive to hormone changes might get much more premenstrual. And I think it is important that they do highlight it. And as the other thing is that women with additional needs as they get older, perhaps on the autism spectrum, or women with Down syndrome might have different needs at the time of menopause as well, so that people realise every woman is entitled to get their access to a healthcare assessment.
Okay, very well said. And it's good to acknowledge that on today, which is World Health Day, that we're all entitled to our health and our health care. Mary, we're going to talk a little bit also this month about pelvic pain, because that's something that you come across quite a lot in your clinic.
Yeah, we come across pelvic pain quite a lot, and that would be acknowledged that in general about 1 in 10 referrals to a gynaecologist are for pelvic pain. And when I say pelvic pain, you know, women will come in, pain somewhere below the belly button in the lower parts of their bodies, and there's always a presumption that it will be gynecological in nature, and it does take quite a thorough assessment to look at pelvic pain, because it isn't always going to be gynecological, but in general they tend to dissipate into our specialty. And your pelvis is obviously the bony area of your body, but within the pelvis you have your womb and ovaries, you have your bladder, you have your bowel, and you have the nerves that supply all of those organs, and they are the same nerves that supply those organs. So when people have some kind of uncomfortable feeling down there, it isn't always going to be from gynecological. If it's gynecological, it does tend to be quite cyclical in nature and maybe come at certain times of the month, and women will have good weeks and bad weeks. If it's, say, for example, endometriosis. Last month was Endometriosis Awareness Month. And we can talk about that in a minute a little bit, because it's an important one to talk about. So when we're looking at pelvic pain, we know the pain can be coming from any of those organs that I dealt with, the bowel, bladder or the womb. And it's just to try and figure out which it is and to get a correct diagnosis and manage that pain.
So you could have a scenario whereby a woman comes to you with pelvic pain and you carry out whatever test, and then you find out that it's not actually anything in your field. You could be referring her to another specialist.
Absolutely, and there's nothing wrong with that, as long as they get to a specialist who actually does tease out what it is. We would take quite a detailed history to look at bowel symptoms, bladder symptoms, where the pain is, what the pain feels like, is it constant, is it certain times of the month, is it likely to be a trapped nerve, because it maybe is referring the pain down their legs or down into their buttocks, might be if it's sciatic or pudendal nerve. So there are a lot of different things that we would look for in the history, and obviously then you have to thoroughly go through the tests that could look for endometriosis. It might be doing a good ultrasound scan. Maybe they'd need an MRI scan. Obviously they get examined. I should have mentioned examination. We forget to examine patients sometimes, and take bloods, tests and swabs and things. So just to work the way through it thoroughly and try and figure out what it is and how best to manage that pain.
Okay, and pelvic pain, I gather, it takes up a lot of time. It's responsible for an awful lot of queries into the Scotia Clinic.
It is, and it's responsible, I think, in general to within the profession. Endometriosis is something that I think has been highlighted specifically in the last year or so, and there's a lot of endometriosis clinics have to be set up in specialist areas under the Minister's new sort of women's health awareness. So we know that endometriosis is a condition where the tissue that lines the womb is other places besides in the womb. It might be around the ovaries, it might be around the bowel, and that blood is triggered to bleed every month just like a period, but it can't escape because there's no pathway, and it builds up and it can cause cysts and scar tissue and cause chronic pain. And I suppose the sad statistic out of all of that is that it can take up to 7 or 8 different doctor specialists that people go to before they ever get a diagnosis. So women do can suffer for quite a long period of time before they come to that diagnosis. And we'd hope now that there's been so much publicity in the last 12 months around the awareness and the need for specialist scans and treatment that women would be diagnosed earlier and then treated earlier. You can never get rid of endometriosis completely, but it's about managing it.
Mm. And if you have endometriosis, it can affect your chances of conceiving, can
it? It can affect chances of conceiving as well. So obviously it's all about the early diagnosis and the early management.
Okay, very good. We've got some questions for you, Mary. Are you ready to field a few? We'll start with one from a listener who emailed and said, my daughter is nearly 14, is very thin and hasn't started her periods yet, even though the other girls in her year have nearly all started. She's quite anxious about this. Is this unusual? So almost 14.
The first thing I would say is, has she had the rest of her puberty development? Is she getting her body hair under her arms, pubic hair, breast development? And if everything else seems okay, I would probably not panic too much until she's about 15. And then maybe it's worth looking at that point. But maybe just to look at the overall development, how is she developing compared to her peers?
Mm. And then you hear as well, the other end of the scale, you hear children, girls having their first period as young as 9.
Yeah.
Which is tough on them as well.
Yeah.
The other end of the scale. We might actually take a break. There's a couple of more questions that have come in through for you, Mary. And just to remind listeners, 066 712 3666 to call. Some more interesting ones coming in as well. If you've got anything to ask Mary McCaffrey in the realm of women's health, please feel free to text it in on 083 300 3300. We'll stay with Mary for another while and we're back in a moment.
Talk about
Women's Health Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Scotia Clinic Rathas Tralee, specialists in fertility and menopause.
Now, Mary, some questions for you. We've a listener who says she's in her 60s, she's on HRT, and I think she means soya. It says soil, S-O-I-L, but I think that might be a typo. And she says she's been on it for 10 years and is wondering, when can she come off HRT?
Well, there's no strict rule about how long anyone must stay on HRT. Normally, we would say for anyone starting on HRT, we would always be reviewing it on a yearly basis and do a significant review at around 5 years, because traditionally we were looking at, you know, do people really need it? Can they come down the dose? And obviously the risk of breast cancer, which is minimal, I must say, exists, and then at 10 years. But I suppose the big reason is why they went on it in the first place. There might be a medical reason why someone is on it, and then that would be up to their doctor to see. Sometimes we just wean people down on the doses and see how they do. We still give them all the advice on managing their bones, being on their vitamin D, looking after their brain and their heart, and lifestyle changes are as important as HRT. So really probably time for her maybe to have a consultation with the doctor who's put her on it to see whether she still needs it.
But there's no lasting damage to being on it indefinitely.
No, there's no lasting. I'd have women who are on it still in their 70s and 80s sometimes. So yeah, it's just maybe just about having a conversation with the doctor.
Okay. Listener says, Mary, would you have any advice for someone who wants to go through menopause naturally without taking anything?
Okay, and there's the age we should be doing that. So if someone is having, say, we always want to protect your bones, so we'd be looking at people being on their vitamin D, on their calcium, on their omega fish oils for their brain function, and they can look at, there's a lot of products with all the vitamins and minerals necessary for menopause, and we mentioned soya already. Sage would be another one. They're all available in health food shops and pharmacies. So a word with a pharmacist can be, or a nutritionist can be helpful. Exercise, very important. Doing your resistance training, being fit so that you're building, you're not losing muscle and you're maybe building muscle and keeping your bones healthy. And obviously diet, very, very important as well, to be getting all the nutrients in your diet. And then people, you know, might sail through menopause quite easily. Later on in life, they might have, for example, a bit of vaginal dryness. They might need just vaginal estrogen. And all the websites that I recommend, the International Menopause Society, North American Menopause Society, and the British Menopause Society, they all have amazing resources for women's health for people to look at.
We actually had a comment in last week from a listener, Mary. This is a bit of an aside, but I'd love your opinion on it.
Okay.
And she said, we were talking to somebody about women and exercise and the importance of bone health and all that. And in that context, this lady got in touch and she said, I wish everybody would stop going on about the menopause. It's all exaggerated. I went through it and I hardly knew I had it. And women nowadays are, you know, they're moaning and complaining about everything and you're going on and on and on about the menopause and it's time to shut up about it. I have to say, it kind of made me quite cross, but
well, I'm delighted for that person that they sailed through it. But there are things like osteoporosis, which are silent diseases that people may not know they have. There are issues such as heart disease, and we know that women in the menopausal age group suffer heart attacks differently to men. So being healthy is always important. And I don't think it's moaning for people to talk about their health. And I think people need to remember as well that, you know, 100 years ago, people probably didn't live long enough after the menopause to even have to deal with health issues. Now women spend 30% of their lives after the menopause. A lot of women leave their workplace and retire early and give up their jobs because they cannot cope because of menopause symptoms. So I think we have to acknowledge that women do suffer. Some women do suffer at menopause. Thankfully, some don't. But we do need to talk about it.
Would you reckon, from your own observations, would be the women who sailed through it, would they be a minority?
Well, of course, I probably never meet them.
You don't, because they only come into you if they have a problem.
But since the whole menopause debate opened up, women are now coming to me older, say in their 60s, saying, if only I had known that I didn't have to go through this years ago.
Yeah,
And I think that was the difference. When I started in gynaecology, say I'm 25 years a consultant, I had hardly any gynae patients. We did hardly any gynae clinics. And women didn't come forward for preventative health. And that's all changed because women now need to keep themselves healthy. And a woman in her 50s may have elderly parents to look after. She may have teenage children, lots of commitments and a busy job. She's at the peak of her career. So people are just more aware of the need to be healthy.
And they won't suffer on like, we'll say, our mother's generation
did. And our
mothers
did suffer. And
they did.
And they did, and they put up with it because they didn't know there were options out there for them.
Yeah, and there are more options than ever now.
Absolutely.
Moving on to another question, and this is from a listener who says, I'm 55, I haven't had a period in 3 or 4 years. At times I have a bit of blood after going to the toilet. I have had kidney and bladder tests done and everything is clear. I'm just wondering what could be going on.
Okay. Well, we would always say to any woman who has abnormal bleeding after her periods have stopped that it should be investigated. It'll in general turn out not to be much. I am hoping this person is up to date with their smear tests because the smear tests will pick up the abnormalities in the cervix, which can be a cause of bleeding. But equally, when a nurse or doctor is taking a smear test, they get a chance to look at the whole vagina and everything as well. In the majority of situations, it'll probably be vaginal dryness that could cause it, but it warrants a visit to a doctor, probably an examination, maybe a scan.
Okay, and on that subject, another question says, as someone who has had cervical cancer 10 years ago, is there a need for cervical checks? The oncologist said on finishing treatment that there was no need as the readings wouldn't be accurate. Is that still the case?
I'm not going to criticise any oncologist, and I think that probably is the case, but I imagine that person is still having some kind of regular checks with the doctor.
Yeah, once she's having some regular checks.
Yeah,
okay, that's fair enough. Catherine wants to ask you, why is there no screening for ovarian cancer, as it's usually symptom-free, and when discovered, it's usually advanced and terminal?
Yeah, and that is one of the biggest dilemmas for us in gynaecology, is that there is no screening cancer for the ovaries because you can't get in to examine ovaries easily without a major intervention. And unfortunately, there isn't any screening test for ovarian cancer. A lot of the tests that people associated with it, such as a blood test CA125, can be raised for lots of other reasons. And the research shows that even though you have a normal scan, normal CA125, in 3 months, 6 months, you still could develop ovarian cancer. So it's very much about being aware of symptoms and perhaps a history. If there was a family history or someone was worried about it, maybe they need to look at and having a review.
Are the symptoms unusual or...?
They're quite vague, bloating, maybe generalised bloating, maybe some bowel changes, maybe a feeling of fullness. They're just unfortunately very vague.
Yeah, it's a silent killer, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a silent disease.
Yeah.
I hate the word killer because it can, even at its late stages, it can be treated and treated effectively with surgery and chemotherapy. But I think that there's nothing, if anyone has symptoms that are bloating, weight loss, bowel changes, always get them checked out.
Yeah, even bowel changes could be a sign.
Bowel changes can be a sign associated with it as well, yeah.
Mm. Okay, very good. I think that's all the questions we have for you, Mary, for this month. So unless there's anything you'd like to, any thoughts you'd like to leave us with before we let you off for Easter.
No, I hope everyone has a lovely Easter and it's lovely and sunny. 15 minutes of a sun a day to keep your bones healthy and get out walking, and we'll start looking into all the salads and healthy eating for the summer.
Brilliant. Mary, have a great Easter. We'll chat to you again in May. Gosh, it's hard to believe it's almost the month of May already.
I know.
Thanks a million. You'll find Mary McCaffrey, by the way, at the Scotia Clinic here in Tralee if you'd like to find out more about the kind of work she does. We'll take a break, folks. It's Danny the Vet.